Subscribe to the Hit That Line Podcast Network, brought to you by Breeden RV Center. Breeden RV Center, family-owned and operated, a no-pressure, laid-back atmosphere, and always home of the free maintenance for life.
No matter what the stats may say, and the experts may think, and the commentators may have predicted, when the race is on, all bets are off. Don't be surprised if somebody decides to flip the script and take a pass on yelling uncle. And then suddenly, as the old saying goes, we got ourselves a game.
This is Trusting the Process.
Season 1, Episode 6 of Trusting the Process. Really excited to welcome in Mike Irwin, senior reporter and analyst for the Pig Trail Nation. Mike, I feel like I have to start with an apology. I woke you up earlier this week when trying to book the interview. I called you a little after 10:30, and for me, I'm up at 4:15, geared up, ready to go, and I know it's a little different for TV, so just to start off this, man, I'm sorry I woke you up earlier this week.
Yeah, I'm fine. I stay up usually pretty late. Don't get home till 10:30. So when I go to sleep at 2 or 3, that's like somebody coming home at 5 and going to sleep at 9. So I tend to sleep later because I go to sleep.
Mike, have you been that way since doing TV, or is that kind of a new occurrence as of late?
No, I've worked essentially a 1:30 to 10:30 shift for 49 years or whatever. So I've been used to this a long time ago.
Mike, let's go kind of back to the beginning. I think you grew up in Morton, Texas. Am I correct in that?
Yes, that's true.
Your dad ran the paper there. Is that kind of early on where you got some early media experience and picked a few things up here and there?
Yeah, I learned a lot from what he did. I never expected to use it. It never occurred to me to get into any type of media. When I got out of high school, I was pretty confused. I couldn't decide what I wanted to do, and I eventually decided that I was going to be a high school football coach and a history teacher. I liked playing high school ball. I liked history, but I got to the – and I really had to work my way through school. I mean, I had full-time jobs in the summer working double shifts and part-time jobs during the school year, and it was rough. It was a struggle for 4 years. And I put all that effort into it, and I got to the spring semester of my senior year doing student teaching, and it was just awful. I was covering a high school. They sent me to a high school in Fort Worth. It was an inner-city school, and I think they'd won 2 games over the last 2 years in football. All of those coaches were on the verge of being fired. Their wives were upset. They would come in. The head coach's wife came in one day to the field house and was crying because she'd been in the grocery store, and on the aisle next to the one she was on, she heard these two ladies talking about their husband, said her husband was going to be fired and what's going to happen to our family and our kids. And one of the other coaches had a kid in high school, and when he went to school every day, all of his classmates told him what a rotten coach his dad was.
Jeez.
And I just had long talks with a lot of those coaches, and they said, you have to be prepared to do this when you get into it, because it's a you win or else kind of life. Mm-hmm. And you can be good for a while. He said, the guy told me, he said, I don't know anybody that's been in this business for very long. It hasn't been fired at least once, and some of them more than once. And I just thought about it when it was over and said, man, I'm not doing that. There's got to be some better way to live. And it didn't matter because I got drafted right out of college. And that's where the change came, because I'd been a radio disc jockey in high school at a little 500-watt AM station. It was just a cool thing to do when you're in high school after school. Run a little board shift, do top 40 radio, you know, all the girls think you're cool. But I did that and didn't think much about it. Well, the Army was so desperate for armed forces radio and television people during the Vietnam era, because most of them were in Vietnam, they had a shortage of jobs stateside. So I came right out of basic training, and they sent me to Fort Benning, Georgia as a disc jockey, which I could do that. But the problem came about 6 months later when they sent me to Fort Rucker, Alabama, as a television news producer, writer, anchor, whatever.
And it's still in the military, right?
Yeah, I'd never done any of that before.
Okay.
And so the guy, fortunately, I had about 6 weeks till the other guy left, and they were sending him to Vietnam. So this Department of the Army civilian who had been in commercial broadcasting, been a news director at a local station, he just said, look, that's what I'm here for. I'll teach you. And he gave me a crash course. I learned in about 6 weeks what I think college students learn these days in about 3 years. And he was a little bit nervous when I anchored the first one because there was no teleprompter in those days. You just kind of had to remember what was down there and look down occasionally and have the ability to kind of memorize that and talk. And when I finished, he said, are you sure you've never done this before? And I said, no, never. And he said, well, look, you should consider this for a career because for the first time, you're already well on your way. Well, I had no interest in news, but about a month after I started that, a local station in Dothan, which was about 15 miles away, the guy calls me, the news director, and asks me if I want to do sports for them at night. And I was like, well, if the Army will let me. And it turned out they did. So I spent a year doing that before I ever got out of the Army. But my first few jobs were all in small markets. Dothan, came back to Texas in Laredo, then went to Lufkin, and I mostly covered high school sports. And it was okay, but I kind of wanted to see what else was out there. And when I got the job in Lufkin, it was close enough to Dallas that I got permission and credentials to cover the Cowboys and the Rangers. And I thought, man, this would be really great. Well, it wasn't. Not for me. There was such a difference in the way these athletes dealt with the media, just their attitude about everything. It was a job for them. And maybe they got some pleasure out of winning games, but not like high school kids did and a few colleges.
Purest form of sport, Mike. High school sports, it's the purest form.
Yeah. And this was the most unpure form when you get up to the pro level. They just were not fun people to be around. So I was pretty discouraged at that point. And I said, well, maybe this is not for me. I hadn't covered a college team that was in a major conference. That was something I hadn't done, and I had got this offer to come to Fayetteville, and it was pretty interesting because there were no television stations in Northwest Arkansas in those days.
Oh, wow.
The two stations in this market were in Fort Smith. It was Channel 40 and Channel 5, and nobody was covering sports up here and lived here. But what would happen is Little Rock, whoever, Fort Smith, they would come up early in the week and load up on interviews and just run that stuff the rest of the week. And it was really pretty bad. And they wanted me to try to do daily coverage and see if that would make a difference. And it did. It helped right away. It got our ratings up. At that time, Washington County was in the Tulsa area of dominance, and that flipped pretty quickly.
And this is Five News, right, Mike? At first.
What?
This is Five News at first, right?
Yeah, Five News. I don't know if they were called Five News at that point, but whatever it was called, I think the news people or some crazy thing. These TV stations have all their gimmicks. But most people, when I first came to work up here, most people got their sports. If they watched television, they watched Chris Lincoln on Channel 8 in Tulsa. Not a Fayetteville or not a Fort Smith station. But when you do daily coverage, when you have breaking stories that nobody else has, the word spreads. And it began to change pretty quickly. But the main thing I liked about this job was the people I was around. Coach Broyles was amazing. He was the most media-friendly coach I'd ever been around, high school, pro, whatever. The guy was unbelievable. He opened up his practices. I could call him, and he would talk to me any time of the day. I could walk in his office unannounced, and Donita would just say, hey, Mike's out here. And he said, come on in. You know, and I'd be in there talking to him. Eddie Sutton the same way. Eddie Sutton's favorite deal was if they lost a game and he sensed the fans were mad, he'd ask me to put a wireless mic on him in practice. And he said, you just record what I say. And he knew a story on that. And you'll show people that I know what's wrong here and I'm going to get it fixed. So it was just fun to do that. Norm DeBrien was so easy to work around. Here's a guy that would... He would chew his players out like you wouldn't believe, and then he would come over to me later and be laughing, and I wonder if I scared him, you know, and stuff like that. It was just fun. All of those coaches were fun to be around, and I said, man, this is a place I can stay. And I got to know people here.
Yeah.
You know, the fans, the passion they have. There's no fans anywhere like Razorback fans. This is the best place in America. I feel like I'm Sam Pittman here, but this is the best place in America to cover college sports.
Mike, there's so much you just said there I want to get into, and you mentioned Norm DeBryan, which I thought was funny. Bubble Carpenter, who does the baseball broadcast with Phil, always talks about that he has so much respect for Norm DeBryan, but that the former players are scared of him in a sense because he just had an intensity, but they would run through a brick wall from him. So what you just illustrated is exactly that. I want to go back because I feel like we kind of glossed over your high school a little bit. So radio jock, what was Mike Irwin like in high school?
Well, I mean, I was really into high school football. I started 3 years on my high school team. I was a captain my senior year. You know, I made all district, all South Plains. That's what I'd always wanted to do. I had those goals. But I also knew I didn't have the talent to play on the college level. For my size, I wasn't fast enough. I was a trapping guard at 170 pounds. You don't do that at the college level. And so it was over when I played my last high school game. I knew I wasn't going to do that, but you know, this radio station opened up when I was a freshman, and there was a guy that started doing an afternoon thing. Then another guy did it, and you had to go to Dallas and get an FCC license. And I actually took a friend down there. He got off school one day on a Friday, and I drove him down there to take the FCC test. And I had no intention of taking that test, and he was having trouble studying in the car. And I said, hey, look, you drive and I will ask you the questions, and by the time we get there you'll have all this stuff memorized. So when we got there, he said, you know this as well as I do, why don't you take the test? And I was like, well, okay. And that's how I got the FCC license. So a job opened up there, and they called me, and I said, sure, I'll do that. And it was cool. You know, you got kids cruising up down the main drag, and they're listening to you after school, and you're doing a typical top 40.
Do you have a jock name, Mike? Did you have a jock name?
I'm Michael James. Oh, that's my first two names.
Let's
Michael
go.
Michael James Irwin. So I just went with Michael James, and, you know, it was Beatles, Beach Boys, Mamas and the Papas, stuff like that. You just play all that music, and it was fun. But it was a high school job. It wasn't anything I was going to do permanently.
See, you mentioned your teaching degree that you got from North Texas State, but last semester or last year, you said, like, I don't want to do this, which is understandable. You brought up getting drafted in the military and kind of how that process started, and then eventually getting the job, and you said one called Five News at the time it started. What was your first radio gig, and how did that all go down, Mike?
You mean after I got into television, the first time I did sports on radio?
First time you started doing sports on radio, yes.
Yeah, that was around 98, 99. Mike Nail was doing a show, and I can't even remember. I think it was 1190 a.m. And he called me one day because he had to be out of town to do a basketball game play-by-play, and he said, I'm going to be gone for 2 days. Would you come in and fill in for me? And Bobby Smittle was the board op. And I remember I walked in there, and I had a two-hour show to do. There were no co-hosts, no call-in thing or any of that. I just blabbed for 2 hours. I also wore myself out. But Mike quit doing that shortly after that, so I started working for Butler, and I worked with probably seven or eight different guys over the years doing what was the original Press Row radio show. It was the original kind of morning show from 7 to 9. Mm-hmm. And it was easy to do because it didn't interfere with my, my television job. And it was fun. It was a learning experience. I did some things I wouldn't do now. I got into politics a lot, which I absolutely have decided is idiotic. I don't think any of us in the media need to mix sports with politics, but I did back then. And, we had fun. I had some co-hosts that I got along with, and some I didn't get along with. But overall, it was fun.
So I do want to dive into that radio bit, but we kind of didn't touch on Mike Nail that much. Mike was gracious enough to give us some of his time, Phil and I, when we were doing halftime, and just to hear that voice, it resonates with so many Arkansas fans. And I know that Mike's not in the best of health at the current moment. Mike, what did you learn, and what was your relationship, and what is your relationship like with the former voice of Arkansas basketball?
You know, when I got here, he had worked at KFSM. He had gone to Little Rock and worked out of their KATV and worked out of their Hot Springs Bureau some. But he went over to Oklahoma City, I believe, as a minor league baseball play-by-play guy. And he was doing that when I got here. And it was maybe a couple of years after I started here that he came back and worked for – he went back and forth between 40 and KNWA, Channel 24, 51, and 2940. He'd work one place a while in the other place and go back and forth. But he was always around. I always saw him. You know, he's just somebody that you work on, like Nate Allen or Grant Hall, a guy that goes back that far, you know, when you have colleagues. The media today is kind of this curious mixture of the Razorback media.
Yeah.
It's kind of this curious mixture of younger guys, and you look at them and you remember when you were that age, and it kind of, you start thinking, oh, yeah, I remember that. And then there's all these older guys like Nate, myself,
Clay,
Grant Hall, Bob Holt. Bob Holt's been around forever.
Yeah.
So Mike Nail was one of those people. He just one of the guys I started off working around.
Man, that's some good stuff there. So you brought up, and I know you probably knew this was coming, you brought up your time at Butler Broadcast. And I have to ask you about this because this is a sports radio legend, and I've never heard you tell this story. What happened with you and Grant Hall, that one altercation? Tell me from your perspective what actually went down.
He and I had two different thoughts on how a radio show should be done. And it was my show, and he came on board. But he didn't, you know, Grant, you've listened to his show. He likes to cover a lot of topics that I had no interest in.
Yeah.
And he would, I kept
by the way, I love Grant. Grant has been one of the nicest guys since I entered sports media. I just want to get that in there, but go ahead, sure. Continue.
Grant and I mean, he's a Democrat, I'm a Republican. I mean, we've always just gone back and forth, but we're friends. And that's just what friends do, and it has a lot to do with the way I grew up. I have a good friend that is in Lubbock right now, and he and I fought all the time.
Yeah.
But we're still best friends. And so we're doing this radio show, and I didn't claim to know a lot about radio, but Bo or somebody had told me that your radio audience turns over in the morning about once every 30 minutes because of the way people are traveling and commuting. And so what you don't worry about, oh, I talked about this in the first hour, you just do it again if it's your big topic. And there would be one or two big topics that I wanted to talk about every morning, and he wanted to branch out into some other stuff, and we would just tangle over that. And we got in an argument about it, you know, during a break, and it got a little physical. it's so funny now to think about it. But, I mean, we got over it. I mean, we went ahead and did the show. It just happened. I just think people that were listening to that show had no idea that we got into a scuffle over that, you know, during a two-minute commercial break. You know, you know, Grant and I, we've gone on trips together. I remember one time anybody that knows me knows that I hate College Station with a passion.
What's worse, College Station or Lubbock?
No, I like Lubbock. I can't stand College Station.
Okay.
And we got into he rode with me down to maybe it was the Southwest Conference baseball tournament. And we got down there, and something happened anyway. He found out he could fly back on a plane that Paul Eales had come in with. And he just came up to me and said, "Man, I'm not going to ride back with you. I'm going with Paul Eales." And he jumps in this plane, and he's gone, and I'm stuck there in College Station. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. I really gave him grief for a long time for that, because he went off and left me virtually – didn't know anybody. I'm sitting there, you know, a Razorback media person in Aggieville, place that I can't tell you how much I don't like being there.
So, Mike, on the note of College Station, why do you hate it so much? Because I've heard mixed reviews. I've never been, so I can't attest to it. I know a Fuego's down there, which is one of the best taco places in the history of the world. Why do you have such a disdain for College Station?
You would have to understand where I grew up. The first games I ever went to were Texas Tech games. I was going to those games when I was 8, 9 years old. I got a lawn mowing job when I was 9 and saved my lawn mowing money so I could go to all the Tech games. I would sit in the end zone, pay $5 per game.
Oh, wow.
And what you have to understand is out there on the South Plains around Lubbock, you got two kinds of farmers. You got farmers that don't have a lot of money that send their kids to Texas Tech. And you've got farmers that have a lot of money that send their kids to A&M because of the reputation as an agricultural school. When those two schools played each other in Lubbock, that was the crowd largely was local people pulling for different teams. And I would go in there, and those local Aggie people would just drive you crazy. I mean, I went in there in high school one time, and I was with one of my high school teammates, and then he had a cousin that played at a place called Seminole.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into it with some Aggie fans after the game because they thought Texas Tech had lost. And it was that famous hook and ladder play with Jerry Don Shipley and Donnie Anderson where he did the lateral and he went 99 yards with about 20 seconds left to go in the game and beat these Aggies. And they'd been giving us grief before that. We got up and we're walking by these people. They're still sitting down and there's a guardrail between us. We're on the walkway. And his cousin just starts slapping these guys on the head. I mean, it turned into a melee. Other fans were involved in it. I mean, it goes all the way back to that. But I've just been to College Station so many times. It would take me forever to tell all the fruitcake stories I've dealt with there. From very early days when you supposedly have a spot reserved on the photo deck and their SID tells you, too bad you got here late. I'm going, I've got a credential. Well, it doesn't matter. It's first come, first serve. You didn't say that. Well, too bad. And just different things like that. The last, Arkansas didn't play there for over 20 years after they went into the SEC.
Yeah.
And that first game that Arkansas played back there again after when that series started up again, it was the Johnny Manziel year. I don't know if you remember that. That mm-hmm. was the game where Manziel had his breakout game, and they beat the John L. Smith Razorback team. But I'm in the – they have an elevator there at Kyle Field. And this was before the renovation. But both Skybox people and media people go up on the same elevator. So we're on this elevator, and I've got this Razorback Nation – that's what we were at the time, Razorback Nation shirt on. And he starts asking me about that, and I tell him where I'm from, and he says, "Why do y'all think about our stadium?" And I said, "Well, it pretty much looks like the last time I saw it." He said, "Well, you sound like you think there's something wrong with it." I said, "Well, you got all this bat gono, this bat dung around here," and I'm telling the truth. They've got bats
yeah.
in that area that go hang under the stadium, and they would just there'd be piles of this stuff everywhere. And he said, "You don't have bats in Arkansas like that?" And I said, "Well, in Arkansas, our bats stay in caves. They don't go to football stadiums." Well, I swear this is true. He turned to his buddy and said, "Did you hear what he said? He said those bats in Arkansas are smarter than our bats." And I thought, oh, my goodness. Oh, get me out of this place.
Get me out of this elevator now. Oh, my gosh. Man, Mike, I'm with you. I hate Texas A&M because – Grandpa, growing up, Arkansas guy through and through, hates the University of Texas. Dad went to Baylor, doesn't like Texas. But I hate Texas A&M more than any university, and I cannot wait to see the Razorbacks beat them at football again.
Screw them. This is your time. Now go out there and take it.
You're listening to Trusting the Process.
You worked with a couple other guys in sports radio, including Bo Mattingly. Now, my first contact with you came not only within the Arkansas press conferences, but also when I was producing John's show, The Forum, and you were a weekly guest on that program. I didn't know. Tommy actually told me this. You used to do a morning radio show with Bo. How far back was that, Mike?
Well, it was during that whole Mitch Mustaine, Houston Nut controversy of 05, 06, back in there.
Okay.
Because we were ground zero for all that stuff back then. Bo had really good, he had a really good relationship with the defensive coordinator at that time. And Danny Nutt was also somebody that would talk to Bo all the time. And Bo found out a lot of stuff through D Nutt and Reggie Herring. And then I had sources over there that I used, but between the two of us, we pretty much knew what was going on over there. And I think that's just, we worked for competing television stations, but we were never like enemies or anything. We were kind of sharing information and trying to figure out what was going on. And the thing I appreciated about Bo and also Wally Hall at the time, you know, I got blamed for a lot of stuff. You know, Mike's anti-Razorback, he hates Houston Nutt. I never one time said Nutt should be fired. I wanted Nutt gone or any of that. I just reported what I knew. And that stuff happened. Whether anybody wants to admit it or not, it happened. It was not good. Players got drawn into a political game that they should have never been involved in. You owe, as a head coach, you owe, in my opinion, you owe your players one thing, and one thing only. If they come in and bust their butt for you, then you owe them at least the respect of, you've come in here, you've worked hard for me, I'm not going to talk bad about you in public. And that was violated a lot during those days, and that's what I didn't like.
The email chain, but I mean, there's so many.
The email whole thing. Now, look, I want to say this. It's important to say this. Gus Malzahn and his people, the people that were on his side, did a very good job of covering up what was going on with them. What was easy to do was figure out what was going on with the Nutt side. And there were things, and this is the way the television business works. There are people that won't tell you things when it's happening that are more than willing a year or two later to open up.
Yeah.
And one of the first things that happened to me was about 2 to 3 years after that was all over and Nutt was gone and everybody was gone. A parent of one of the players told me that Malzahn told him when he was recruiting him that if anything happened to Nutt, he would be the next head coach. And I went, whoa.
Wow.
You know, if he said that, Houston knew about it. And that sort of explained why Houston freaked out when that whole hire was pushed on him.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 2 or 3 years later, I was told by somebody that was very close to Frank that they had a problem back in those days. Frank was in his 80s. They knew John White wanted Frank out. They were terrified that if Frank didn't retire voluntarily and name his own successor, John White would, and they would get somebody they didn't want. So a bunch of these people concocted a plan to bring Gus Malzahn on as the offensive coordinator.
So this is true.
Let Arkansas be successful under him. Houston wins a couple of championships. Then they go to Houston and say, you're the closest thing to Frank Broyles we have. You know how to give a speech. You know how to make people in Arkansas love you.
Yeah.
We got to get Frank to step down, and you got to take one for the team and be the AD. And then we'll make Malzahn the head coach. That was their plan. Now, they never even got around to the point where they mentioned it to Frank, and they never got around to the point where they mentioned it to Houston. But he knew about it, I'm sure. And Gus, I'm sure, knew about it.
Yeah.
And that's what caused all the issues there. And so it puts Nutt, a much different light when I found all that stuff out. It certainly explained why he was paranoid about all that.
That can make
sense. He had no interest in being an AD. They couldn't have talked him into it. That's not what he was. And it was a perfect example of what goes wrong when boosters start trying to solve problems.
Man. That's just a great Mike Irwin tidbit that you're not going to be able to find many other places. You hear sometimes rumors through the grapevine. I have different people tell me this, different people tell me that, and that's just a great story. So we've talked about, Mike, we've talked about your time with Grant, your time with Bo. Another guy that you've gotten to know over the years is Marty Houston, and I always saw these pictures of you guys passed out on road trips in the back, which found funny. Now, you guys didn't do radio together. I think he would do it separate times, but what's your relationship been like with Marty Houston, a guy that a lot of our listeners know, and what's that been like over the years?
You know, I started watching Marty when he was on that the Noon Huddle. It was a radio call-in show that was on TV from noon to one every day, 5 days a week. And a lot of people thought that show was corny. I thought it was absolutely hilarious. Marty had he was a perfect fall guy for any of the hosts that he had, but Ernie Witt, that name was, you know, it suited him perfectly because he was very witty.
Yeah.
And he knew how to kind of take little shots and digs at Marty. And Marty's great value on that show is he never got angry. He just kept his sense of humor. They talked about the Razorbacks. They talked about the Cowboys. And people loved watching that show while they were eating lunch. And so I just watched it all those years. Well, then when I went to KNWA, he works for them. And suddenly I'm working around this guy. And it was just great, you know. Marty's a really funny guy behind the scenes. On these road trips, you can just, I mean, I sit back there and I take the Ernie Witt role. I just nail him with anything I can think of. And he just, he's coming back, explaining this, explaining that. No. That's it. He's a big Dallas Cowboys fan, and I just give him grief about Jerry Jones all the time. Jerry, the best thing that could happen to the Cowboys is Jerry sold the team. Jerry's a good promoter, but he didn't know a thing about football, blah, blah, blah. And we get in some huge arguments about that, and it's mostly all in good fun.
I want to talk about your time at KNWA coming up, but one of the most vivid memories that I have when you were working for KFSM at 5 News was you getting mobbed at the College World Series live. How irritating was that to be mid-broadcast and all of a sudden a bunch of what I assume drunk Razorback fans just surround you and almost topple over you? What do you remember about that night?
Well, it was very confusing because I didn't know what was happening. Now, backstory on that, the night before, we'd been over on the sort of the side of the stadium. We were trying to move around different locations and do these live shots. And we'd been off to the side of Rosenblatt, and it's a kind of a park-like setting all around that stadium.
Pre-DT.
It doesn't exist.
Pre-TD Ameritrade, yeah.
Right, pre-TD Ameritrade. And a guy explained to me later on that they had a problem for several years in that local college kids that didn't have the money to go to Florida on spring break would just go to the College World Series and raise hell and drink out in that big, huge park area and get drunk. High school kids started doing it. And the night before, we'd been trying to do a live shot, and some high school kids got into it with some college kids, and it almost spilled over into our live shot. They were fighting.
Oh, wow.
I was very nervous about it. So it's the next night. We're going live. These people show up. I don't know who they are. They're all around us. We're on the air. They're pushing. They're crowding. I didn't do anything that much to me, but they were kind of pushing from behind, and I was getting jostled around. But they were getting in front of the camera, and I could not see Charles Frazier, who was my live shot operator and camera guy. And I could just see him briefly as people moved around, and he had his hands up. And I thought they were attacking him. So I was supposed to pitch to this pre-recorded piece anyway, they're about 2 minutes long, and then when I did that, they were supposed to take that. And I did it. I waited for about 10 seconds thinking, okay, now we're not on the air. Although it was so loud, you couldn't tell. And then I started tossing people.
Shoving kids out of the way.
My whole thing at that point was get these people out of the way, and then I'm going to go find security and get them out of here. Because I didn't know what was happening, but I didn't want them beating on the photographer and doing all this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out the guy running the shot in Fort Smith thought it was funny and just left it on the air. So the whole thing just went out. And it's kind of funny to look at now, but it wasn't funny at the time simply because I was very confused about what was happening. I didn't know who these people were. It turned out they were a bunch of 12- and 13-year-old youth league baseball kids from Ohio that were in town for a tournament And they were just out there running around having a good time. But I didn't know that. I thought they were maybe drunk LSU fans or whoever. And if I'd known that they were just out there having fun, I would have had a different attitude. But I was really worried that they were, you know, pounding this guy who was trying to run the live shot.
Yeah, man. That's it. I had no idea about that. I don't think you ever told that story when I was doing the forum, so I'm glad I got to hear that. You brought up LSU. We're definitely going to get to their head coach and your experience with him at Arkansas coming up, as well as Frank Broyles. But I want to talk about KNWA for a sec. You moved from KFSM to KNWA. Mike, what I've been told, and you kind of clear the air on this and let me know if it's right or not, did Five News not re-up your contract, and then as soon as KNWA saw that, they hopped on? What happened when between KFSM and KNWA?
Well, I didn't have a contract. I had worked all those years without one. Basically, what happened was the guy running the station had fired John Engelman on a Friday, and then when I came to work on, I worked all weekend, and then when I came in on Monday, he had a meeting with me, and he just said, "Look, we're retiring you." I said, "Well, you know, I'm 63 years old. I got about three more years before I can collect Social Security, so that's kind of not very cool." And he said, "Well, we're going to give you a 6-month severance pay." And I said, "I'll take it," because I figured I could find another job in 6 months. And I shook his hand and walked out the door. I came home, and we...
Mike, what year was this, by the way?
2012.
2012, okay. So you're 60, so you're what now? 60?
I was 63 then, okay. Whatever that adds up to.
You 71
anyway,
now?
John and I had been working virtually 12-hour days, trying to do all the things that they had piled on us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was exhausted. And I went home and went to sleep. Somebody called me about this. This was about 2 in the afternoon when that happened. Somebody called me about 3 or 4, and I think it was a newspaper person, wanting to know if I'd been fired. And I said, "Well, I guess so." They called it a retirement, but I guess I don't have a job there. I said, "I've got a severance package, you know, but I'm not going to be working there." I guess somebody, probably Jason Carroll at KNWA, heard that. So he has to go talk to people at KNWA, people above him. And at 6:30 that night, he called me and asked me if I would go to work for them. And I said, "Well, yeah, sure." And he said, "Okay, look," he said, "you know, we got these rules in television. You've got to interview all kinds of people. You've got to advertise the job for 10 days, blah, blah, blah. We're going to do all this stuff. So it may take a while, but we're going to hire you if you'll agree to work here." And I said, "Sure." And sure enough, 2-3 weeks went by, and they called me and said, "Okay, come in on Monday. It's your first day." And I filled out paperwork the first day. Second day, we went to the College World Series, and I did like 8 live shots. I'd never worked at a place where you did live shots for 2 different television stations, KNWA and KARK.
Mm-hmm.
I did like 8 or 9 live shots that first day, and my head was swimming. But it was fun. I enjoyed it, and it's really the best place I've ever worked. You just have to be in that environment to understand it. We've got our own sports studio where we work.
Yeah.
So we're the only ones in there. This whole COVID thing, the 5 of us have been in that room this whole time, and nobody's gotten COVID. And I guess we're socially distanced. That room is big enough that people are sitting about 10 or 15 feet away from each other. But I find it remarkable that we've all been in there all this time and none of us have had it. We all get along. Everybody knows everybody. Probably the most comfortable work environment I've ever been in. Alyssa and Tara are just great to work with. They've got good knowledge of athletics, but they're fun to be around.
Mm-hmm.
Jason is he's just the glue that holds everything together. He's the sports director. We got told when that whole thing happened with no bowl game, with virtually no notice, we had a bowl special scheduled. And we got told, "Well, you still got to do it. Just figure out how to alter it." So we had about 1 day to change a bowl special into whatever we were going to make it.
Jeez.
And Jason sat down and formatted that thing and wrote a lot of it and got it all set up. And all we had to do was just get on there and talk. And he did it in about 6-7 hours. That's his value to us. He's just, when you have somebody like that to kind of keep everything together, then all you have to worry about is your on-air stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so much fun to work there. You've got the support of management. You've got great people in Little Rock that support you. And I've never worked anywhere like in a work environment like what I've got now, where we've had that many people. We're all in there together. We've got projects we work on. It goes way beyond just, okay, we got to worry about the 6 and 10 o'clock sport. I mean, we're doing, you know, a pig trail show every Sunday. We're doing specials every time we turn around. During football season, we've got a gear-up show that lasts 20 minutes on Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
We've got specials constantly that we're producing, and all that stuff has to be organized, and Jason's the guy that organizes it, and we just do our job. And I just, they called me in the other day and wanted to know if I was going to sign another contract, and I said, sure, if you want me to. So I'm on board for another year. I'm signing one-year contracts. That was my idea, because at my age, I think that's what you need to do. You want to constantly make sure you're in good enough. I told my boss, I said, look, if you notice me like going downhill, saying daffy stuff on the air, just say, hey, it's enough.
Hold the plug.
Time for you to retire, and I'll be fine with it. So they haven't said that so far, so I guess I'm all right.
Now, what are you going to do?
You're listening to Trusting the Process.
Mike, let's talk about your health, because I know you had a scare a few years back, and it was scary to me to hear that you were going through something. What did you go through a couple years back that left you where you couldn't do the Pig Trail Nation, at the time Razorback Nation, for a little bit?
That was actually 4 years ago. It's hard to believe, but I came down with something called diverticulitis. It's basically infections in your colon. I had 3 separate infections. I'd never been in a hospital in my life. And all of a sudden, I go in there. They have to do this laparoscopic surgery where they poke a thing down there and they were putting like antibiotics into those 3 areas of infection. And they cleared it up within about a week.
Mm-hmm.
But I had problems after that, and I had to go in and be checked again, and they told me, you've got scar tissue down there. Some of that's got to come out. So they reduced the size of the colon down there, and when you do that, you got to wear one of those bags for 2 months, and that was awful. I see these commercials where people say that where they have to wear them permanently, and they've adjusted to it. I guess so. Not for me. So I had to go through that. Then in the middle of all that, my gallbladder went bad. And the gallbladder was right under where the ostomy was. And they kept telling me that every time you have a gallbladder attack, just come in the hospital, we'll put you on antibiotics. And then
it's all that Taco Bell, Mike. It's all that Taco Bell, man.
Yeah. So, oh my goodness. I mean, I'm going in there, I'm getting all these antibiotics, getting back out. It kept happening. So finally the surgeon told me, he said, look, I'm reattaching all this stuff on him. He gave me a date, and he said, I'm taking that gallbladder out at the same time. So they did all of that in December. But then I had other complications, and I got really, really sick. I don't know if I almost died, but I started having hallucinations. I'll tell you that.
Jeez.
I mean, I had a hallucination one time that I was talking to my wife. She came in, and I said, you know, yesterday when I said this to you, and she said, I wasn't here yesterday. And I said, yeah, you were. You were right over here. And the nurse said, you were talking to the IV hookup. You know, they got this little cart with your IV stuff up there. And I thought that was her. And I had another crazy hallucination where I was walking in the bottom of a creek, at the bottom of a canyon. It was freezing cold. There were all these voices that were in my head, and I couldn't figure out where they were coming from. And I looked up and saw these like Native Americans on horses, and they were old guys, and they were communicating with me telepathically.
Did your nurse like slip in mushrooms to your IV? Like, how?
No, it was what it was. They were giving me Dilaudid, which is a step above, whatever that morphine, it's above morphine.
Okay, there's
the pain was just unbelievable. And that stuff will cause you to hallucinate. And so, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, these Indian, they were like Indian medicine men or something, but I somehow knew in my dream or whatever was happening that they were dead. And they were communicating with me and telling me that I had, that people of my race had taken away their land and they wanted it back and I was paying the price for it. Maybe this guilt over something. I don't know what it was.
Man.
But when I woke up, I remembered that was the most unbelievable dream I've ever had in my life. But I got over it. I got out 2 days before Christmas, and I was able to come home and have Christmas with my wife and kids and grandkids. And I haven't been sick since.
Good. So. Let's hope it stays that way. So you brought up your wife, Mary. She was a reporter initially when you guys met, right?
She was. She was an intern. She was a weekly, got paid, how do I put this? She was part-time, I think 20 hours a week, working in news up here and going to the University of Arkansas.
How'd you ask her out, Mike?
You know, it was kind of an accident, really. She was engaged at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I had a good friend that kept trying to get her to break up with this guy and go out with him, and she wouldn't do it. And one night I walked by her desk, and she had been the editor of her high school newspaper. So she knew print writing, but she was struggling writing broadcast style. And I walked by the desk, and she asked me for some help because somebody had told her that I'd done both. And I had, with my experience growing up with my dad's newspaper, and I wrote for an Army newspaper when I was in the Army. And so I could do both, and it was almost like an interpreter interpreting different languages. I would take her script that she had written and show her how you turn that into a broadcast script. And she wanted to learn more about that. And I was on my way to a party. And I said, well, you can go to this party if you want to. And she said, okay. And we got over there. And it turned out that the party was being held in the apartment of her fiance's best friend. It was a total, I don't even know how, that's just so weird.
Oh my goodness.
And so she almost didn't go in there, and I told her, she told me what had happened. I said, look, I didn't do this on purpose. I don't know anybody at this party except Greg Mills. And he was a writer for the Springdale paper.
Yeah.
I said, he's the one that invited me to this thing. And she said, well, let's go ahead and go in there. And so she went in there. I guess the guy got all over and called her fiance, and then they had an argument over the phone. She broke up with him, and I started going out with her not long after that, and we got married about 7 or 8 months later, and that was 42 years ago.
Mike, what has Mary meant for your career? I know you've spoken on this, how much she has just had an impact with Josh and Perry. What has she meant for your career?
Well, I think because she started out in television, she understood the job. She understood my hours. I think she understood, especially when our kids were young, that was back during the Nolan Richardson years when they were going to the NCAA tournament and going far into the tournament. We were a CBS station, and they wanted us there at every stop. And I would sometimes be away from home for 3 weeks, almost a month, if you throw in the SEC tournament. And she had her own job. We had these two kids. She was getting them up in the morning, getting them off to school, going and doing her own job, coming back home, picking them up after school, you know, making them do their homework, cooking supper, putting them to bed. And I don't know too many women that would put up with that as much as she had to. And I got this Lifetime Emmy Award several years ago in Branson, and there's a lot of media people in this big auditorium. And I looked at them and I said, you people that are in this business know there's not many of you that have done it for very long that aren't divorced because your spouse won't put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of you have stayed in the business because you're single. And I said, I want to pay tribute to my wife because she's the only reason I've been able to do all this, because if she had been typical, if it had been a typical situation, you probably told me to get lost a long time before this. But she just always understood that was the job. that's what had to be done. And she did her part, and there's no way I could have done it without it.
Mike, your dad was in the newspaper business. You were in the television and radio business. It probably wasn't a surprise that Josh kind of followed in your footsteps in the television business as well.
He was always interested. When I would come home after the 6 o'clock and he was here, and I felt guilty because I wasn't around him a lot, and he would always want to go back to the station with me. Well, it's kind of a more relaxed thing at night after all the management people go home. And I would take him with me, and he would go in the control room, and those people loved him. And before I knew it, he was sitting there at age 6 or 7 switching the newscast. They taught him how to do it. And he's sitting there pushing the buttons, and he just developed a great interest in the video end of the business. And he also started doing some things at what then was called Open Channel, which was you could go in there and produce your own movies, you know, your amateur movies. And he had his own camera, and he's just always been interested in that type of stuff. But because he was around me so much, he learned a lot about sports, even though that's not strictly where his interest was. It was more in the producing of the videos, excuse me, and all of that. But my youngest son is completely the opposite. He had no interest in any of that. He always wanted to be a pastor, and he's got a degree in a seminary degree from a school up in St. Louis, or Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay,
but you know, I just had one son that was always interested in what I did, and I had another one that just went in another direction.
So I brought up your kids a little bit. What's it been like being a grandpa with 5 grandkids, Mike?
Well, the best part of it is that we all live around here. I mean, I know people that get to see their grandkids like twice a year or whatever. I mean, my youngest son and his wife and 2 kids live on the other side of the block from us. I'll be out in the front yard, and my 2 grandkids over there just come up. Hey, Granddaddy, what are you doing? Well, I'm mowing the yard. You want to help? Sure. You know, that kind of stuff. I've got Josh and his wife and 3 kids live in Bentonville. So it's a little farther up there to see them. But most Sundays they all come in here, and we have dinner together, and we're obviously always able to have Christmases together and things like that. And that's the best part of it, because in so many families, you've got the grandkids and the kids separated from the grandparents, and that's not a good situation. Believe me, when you become a grandparent, you'll figure it out, man. You want to be around those grandkids.
Mike, I want to shift the conversation a little bit. You've gotten a chance. You brought up Frank Broyles, Norm DeBrien, Mike Neal. You've gotten to meet some incredible figures within Razorback history, and I'll start with Frank because I don't think we've spent enough time on him. You talked about how he was easygoing with the media. You could sit outside his office. You'd listen to Frank and his secretary with day-to-day activities. But I haven't heard your Frank Broyles impersonation. Can you give our listeners right now your best Frank Broyles impersonation?
It would generally happen when I told a story about whatever happened. You know, I remember I would go over to Frank's office and his secretary, Donita. I would tell her, Donita, I need a place to sit down. My feet hurt. And that was baloney. Frank always left his door open to his office, and you could sit there and hear his phone conversation. And this particular situation occurred when he was having all these problems with Lou Holtz, because Lou never got any sleep. He was an insomniac. And if you've ever known anybody that doesn't sleep properly, they're angry all the time. And Lou would have these outbursts, and it didn't matter who was around him. He'd just go off on them. Boosters, you know, big boosters, a simple manager, a player, mm-hmm. somebody like me. And Frank was always fielding complaints. And I would sit there and listen to him on the phone, and he'd say stuff like, I know, I told Lou, you got 2 strikes against you as a coach the minute you become a coach. You don't need strike 3, but he don't listen to me. You know, I would just tell stories like that. Frank would just, he was amazing. He I still remember the day he was trying to decide who he was going to hire after Jack Crow got fired. And a lot of people thought he was going to hire Tom Osborne out of Nebraska, but Osborne, it turned out, wanted to wait and make a decision until after the January 1st bowl game. Frank knew recruiting was coming into play, so he had to decide between Kenny Hatfield and Jimmy Johnson. And I think he was a little bit afraid that Jimmy might get Arkansas on probation, and he went with Hatfield, but he was still kind of fooling around with this Tom Osborne thing. And we're all up there at the Broyles Center, and they, in those days, they had this big room where media could just come in there. You had desks you could sit at.
Yeah.
It was a workroom. And we're all in there in this workroom because we figure the story's going to break that day, and Frank's going to come down and tell Rick Schaefer, and we're going to all have the story. Well, Frank comes down. He looks at us, but he sticks his head in Rick's office and says, while we're all listening, "You can tell everybody to go home. There ain't nothing happening today. I mean nothing. It's not settled." And then he walked off. So guys were grumbling and griping, and they all got up, and they started leaving. So I started to leave, and I'm looking around, and it looks like everybody's leaving, but I'm not going to leave. I got in my car and did a big loop down Stadium Drive, down to MLK, back up Razorback Road, and I'm just going to make a big loop and come back in there because I don't trust Frank. I don't know what he's up to, but I'm not trusting that it's not going to be announced that day. And I look around, and Grant Hall is following me. And so I get back up to the parking lot, and I go, "You need to go home." And he said, "I'm not going home." So now there's two of us there. Then Nate comes out of nowhere, so there's three of us, but about seven or eight others have left. And we're sitting in there, and I mean, not 15 minutes later, Frank comes in, "Rick, I got a news release for you." And he comes in and hands him this news release where Ken Hatfield has been hired. So we grab him. "You got to talk to us, Coach. You got to talk to us." So we got him out in the hallway, and I just remember somebody said, "Well, what happened? I thought you were going to do this or that, or you were going to wait, blah, blah, blah." And he goes, "The situation got too volatile. It was just too volatile. I run the risk of not getting a good coach at all, so I had to pull the trigger now." And those are just some of the things that I would, you know, stories I would tell, things that you heard and saw when you were around Frank.
Well, that's a gem in itself. Mike, I would ask your opinion. Did Frank Mike make the right decision when he hired Ken Hatfield over Jimmy Johnson?
Well, that is hard to say. Jimmy, I don't think Jimmy ever got Miami on probation. He was a hell of a coach, and he really, really, really wanted that job.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's still spurned by Arkansas a little bit that he didn't get that job. I have a sense of that. Maybe you do too.
Oh, he's still a little bit upset about it. I think he and Frank finally got over that, but or past it. But I think it probably still bothers him a little bit. You know, Jimmy's version of that story was that Frank told him he wanted the job when Lou got the job. And Frank told him at the time, "You need to go off," because he'd been the defensive coordinator at Arkansas. And Frank told him, "Look, you need to go somewhere else and get some experience as a head coach." And so he went off to Pitt, I think is where he went, and he was defensive coordinator there. And then he got the job at Oklahoma State. And I think he felt like he'd done what Frank asked him to do. "I've become a head coach. I'm successful. I'm right here in this area. I can recruit this area. You need to hire me." And when we interviewed him, when he came in and did his interview, he was very confident he was going to get the job. And then I started hearing that Frank was a little bit worried about, you know, maybe some probation issues, maybe skirts a little bit on recruiting, and he knew Kenny was just like a Boy Scout. And so he decided to go with Hatfield. Hatfield, you know, to this day has the highest winning percentage of any Razorback coach ever.
Mm-hmm.
He was successful. But he was very stubborn, and Frank knew that Hatfield was a great coach himself. He did not have a staff that was at his level, and that was the source of the trouble between them, because Frank was always telling Hatfield, "You got to get a better staff. I will help you do it. I know coaches all over the country. I can find the best offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator. I will get you the best coach ever at every position." And Hatfield said, "No, I hire my own staff." And that's really what started the problem with them. So You know, Frank was a very practical guy. When that happened, he just got those coordinators other jobs. He got Fred Goldsmith the head coaching job at Rice by just telling the Rice people, oh, this guy's great. You need to hire him. And he had him out of his hair. They brought in, you know, two new coordinators. And what happened after that is proof that Frank knew what he was talking about. Because the next 2 years, Arkansas won the Southwest Conference. They went to the Cotton Bowl two straight years. And Hatfield was just mad about all that and used that to get the Clemson job. I don't think he should have left. I think if Ken had stayed here and had not been angry about all that and just, to me, I'm a very practical person. If somebody tells me you need to do this and I kind of listen to them and do it, even though I'm sort of feel like I'm forced to do it,
yeah,
and it works, good for them. They knew, I didn't. And Kenny just didn't take that attitude. He felt like if I stay here, Frank's going to try to run my program and I have to run it myself. But I always felt like Frank made the right call there, and I really wish Hatfield had gone along with that and just said, hey, you did the right thing. I needed to change coordinators. Look at the difference it made. I mean, he hired Jack Crow as his offensive coordinator. That guy was amazing as an offensive coordinator. He turned Arkansas's offense completely around in 1 year and then ended up being the head coach, and he was not head coaching material. He was a coordinator all the way.
Mike, you mentioned some staff members on Arkansas. This will be the last question, which we'll let you go. I really appreciate you doing this. This has been phenomenal. So many of our listeners are going to listen to this, whether tonight, the rest of the week, next month. They're going to thoroughly enjoy it. The story I remember you telling, I want to say this was when you were on the forum, is the Ed Ogeron story. Ed Ogeron is a GA at the time for, I believe, Lou Holtz, and you're up filming in the stands. And he walks up, and you can't understand. He's trying to say, coach says cut it. And you can't understand. You keep saying, what? Coach says cut it. And you can't understand him. Take us back to your first experience with Ed Ogeron, the talking rock, now LSU's head coach.
Well, he was a GA, but he was a GA in the weight room. And we would see him from time to time, and, you know, we would always stand at the gate of the practice field and talk. I'm talking media people. Everybody's standing around talking. And Ed would come up, and he'd start that. We know what he was talking about, and it was embarrassing. I mean, when somebody asks you a question, you can only say so many times, could you repeat that? And then it becomes embarrassing. So people would leave when they saw him. We'd get out of the way. Then one day, it's a spring football scrimmage. And everybody has permission to shoot. And I'm about halfway up the west side of the stands. There's camera to my left, one further down to the right. And I'm looking into the viewfinder, and all of a sudden it goes dark. And I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with this camera. And I look up, and Ed is standing in front of the lens, and he has his belly covering the lens. He's just standing there with his stomach right in front of the camera. I said, Ed, what are you doing? He said, coach says cut it. I said, what? He said, coach says cut it. And I said, Ed, look around you. Everybody's shooting. Why would he tell me to cut it? Coach says cut it. Well, I didn't have any choice at that point. I wasn't going to get in an altercation with him, so I stopped. But I didn't have anything from that point on. And so I went up to talk to Rick, and he said, I don't know, let's go talk to Hatfield. This was when the scrimmage was over. So I go up to Ken, and I'm like, what is this? And he said, oh, no, 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 I'm so sorry. He said, I looked up there, and I thought you were a high school coach filming us. And I sent him up there to tell you there was no need for that because we have tapes available of the scrimmage to all of the high school coaches. That was the week of the coaching convention.
Yeah.
He said, he just misunderstood what I said. And I'm like, sure, okay. And I remember when he started finally making a name in the coaching business, and, I mean, he was at several different places. He was at USC. He was head coach at Ole Miss. And then later LSU, I'm thinking, how did this guy ever become a head coach? He was one of the goofiest people I've ever been around. But that's just one person's perspective. I'm sure he could tell you a different version of that, but that's the way I remembered that.
Mike Irwin, senior reporter and analyst for the Pig Trail Nation. This has been Season 1, Episode 6 of Trusting the Process. Mike, as we let you go, stay off the roof, man. You were talking about your health earlier. I know that you're stubborn when it comes to that, but we want to keep watching you on your TV Really appreciate your time today, Mike.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Long range! Are you kidding me?
He's got his J back, folks, and the eye of the tiger.